Right now, however, Hayden Donnell is joining me for Midweek Media Watch. But before we hear from him, he wanted us to hear from this.
The familiar sights and sounds of courier vans zipping around during lockdown. The drivers are some of the unsung essential service heroes, making sure our packages kept coming, no matter the risk to themselves or their families.
Wow, that was an excellent little soundbite. Hayden, welcome back to Nights.
Thank you for having me, Brian.
And tell me, why did you choose that?
Now, so I chose that because that was the first 15 seconds of the first story on Checkpoint on Friday night. And I don't know if people have been listening to this for a while. I've spoken about the media's coverage of essential workers before, and I've said that it should be ongoing in this post-COVID landscape. So this is an encouraging sign to me. And I just thought I'd talk a little bit about this story. At the crux of this story is this allegation from First Union's Jared Abbott, and I have a clip of it.
Freightways companies are deducting the wage subsidy from their independent contractors' remuneration, which to me, like, it entirely shows that, A, they do believe they're their employer because they're taking the employer subsidy. But secondly, it just seems like they're rorting everyone because they're not giving discounts to the customers. They've said themselves they've got triple the workload they usually do, and then they're taking the money back off the people that are actually entitled to the money. It's really a three-way rip-off of the customers, their workers, and the government.
So, Hayden, this is an example of a bouquet I think you're handing out for journalists getting stuck in and digging around and trying to hold some people to account here.
Yes, it is. And this is actually something that Checkpoint has covered for years, right back to the time it was hosted by John Campbell. So courier drivers is kind of Checkpoint's round. So, but if that does sound a little bit incomprehensible to you, then it has been explained elsewhere very ably by Tuila Fuatai in a commentary piece for the Herald. And so what Jared Abbott from First Union is saying there, the context is that courier drivers are essentially treated as, well, they are treated as independent contractors by their employers, the courier companies, but they are essentially treated as employees with regular routes, regular pay. They're beholden to one company, essentially. And in this crisis, the courier companies have essentially decided that they are employers now, and they have asked all of their drivers to apply for wage subsidies, and then they've said, we'll top up your pay to about 90% of what you'd regularly get. There's a few problems with this. Independent contractors, that's what employers are meant to do under the wage subsidy scheme. It's not what should be happening for independent contractors. Essentially, the courier companies are pocketing this money, the wage subsidy money, and the courier drivers and the government are kind of going without.
And 90% of what they regularly get, so 90% of their wage or the payments they were getting before the pandemic? Is that...
Yes, yeah. So that seems to be the case. So courier companies are saying, we haven't lost any work. They've said that actually, courier drivers are saying they haven't lost any work. They're doing actually more work than they were doing before, but they've essentially had to take this enforced pay cut. Tuila's piece kind of finishes with this observation. As union representatives have pointed out, if drivers are not benefiting from the wage subsidy and parcel delivery levels are stable, who is getting the extra COVID-19 government money? Follow the breadcrumbs and you end back at courier companies and the independent contractor model. And the system has never worked, she concludes. And that's a pretty fair assessment, and it's one that will possibly put pressure on the Labor government, which was already looking at changing this model where courier drivers are essentially treated as employees but labelled independent contractors.
This is one example of, and I remember you talking about just coverage of the lot of essential workers in previous chats here on Nights and previous Midweek Media Watches. And there's been a little bit more of that from News Hub this time.
Yeah, News Hub's done, this is just to follow on from the courier drivers story as well, because they're essential workers, but News Hub's doing a series on essential workers. They've done a story just interviewing two supermarket employees about the changes that they see coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic. And it's just nice to see the spotlight still on these workers, because it puts pressure on the companies that employ them to actually treat them very well, and possibly actually creates political pressure to, I guess, improve the lot of these people that got us through COVID-19.
I think another thing I would mention is a couple of the news sources, News Hub and New Zealand Herald, they still work on that good old-fashioned business model of your journalism is funded by the advertising we get, and we devote some of that back to the journalists, and they dig around and they come up with stuff which actually is shining a pretty useful light on something.
Yeah, now all of those companies are still funded by this ad model. But it's interesting, something that I observed with this, and particularly Tuila's piece, is that this is an example of the media ecosystem working as it should, and it's working well. I spoke to Rebecca White of New Zealand Geographic about this a little bit, where you have this breaking news story, in this case done by Checkpoint, and then you have this analysis, the synthesizing that explains the news and helps to draw out new points, and that's what Tuila's done. And that's working well in this case. The thing is that has not necessarily been the way that things have been done recently. You know, we have this expansion of pretty cheap opinion that often isn't very illuminating. And in some ways, that's understandable because opinion drives clicks and eyeballs, and the media really needs those things to sell its ads. But that ad model is eroding as Facebook and Google takes the dollars, as we've often talked about, and the future possibly is something that looks a little bit more like this, where you have premium value-adding content that people really want to actually go out of their way to pay for. So I see this as maybe an encouraging sign, or possibly a sign of the future in action. Maybe we are going to get more sort of a media ecosystem that functions a little bit more like this, where you have really good pieces of journalism at both ends and a focus on quality rather than just getting clicks.
Well, I may be really out of touch. In fact, I'm probably definitely out of touch, but I just don't have an appetite for a story which is a story about reaction to somebody else's opinion. Somebody else is famous first and says something outrageous or shocking, and it's actually the story is then it's a reaction to this. It's not even the story. It's already moved on from whatever they said, because they would have said that in the media somewhere, and then it's the reaction, and on it goes. And
I think you may not be in touch with the regular New Zealanders. The fact is, having worked in these media organizations,
I work at the wrong time of day. I work at night. I've been working at night for almost 15 years now.
The thing is, even if it angers people, that anger generates clicks. Opinion like the Hoskins of the world as well. It's less time intensive and it's less resource intensive than really rigorous journalism.
I try so hard not to click. Don't feed the trolls, the voices tell me. Don't click, don't click. Move away, Brian, move away.
That's true. If you do hate it, then the best thing is probably to starve a bit of oxygen. Not that we've been all that successful on that front all the time ourselves.
But here at the different media organisations, both, all of them, RNZ, The Herald, News Hub, chipping away at an issue, which is encouraging. I guess I don't know if it's cynical, but maybe you could also say that the union that represents the courier drivers is also doing a good job here in getting this issue out into the public domain.
Yeah, I thought this is one other interesting observation from this story. It's obviously been seeded, or it's actually been aided by First Union, Jared Abbott of First Union. And I just think that that's one of the functions of unions that is often a little bit underrated or under remarked upon, that they can actually, they have this function in that they will help workers unite and exercise power against their bosses, but they also have this function of getting things into the media, getting contacts into the media, and creating political pressure through media campaigns. And I mean, that's obviously been a function for a long time, but this is it in action, and is actually possibly one of the most important things that unions can do: create a narrative and impetus to help the workers that they represent through the media.
Okay, that's the media bouquet tonight. Now we're going to move on to the media. This makes us slightly uncomfortable. We're not quite sure what we think about this one. Now, Ben Smith, the only Ben Smith I knew until I saw your notes tonight was an All Black fullback. And I hadn't heard of Ronan Farrow, but I do read the magazine he wrote for, or writes for, The New Yorker, quite a lot. Now, tell me about this. Ronan Farrow is too good to be true, was the headline that Ben Smith wrote, and this caused a stir. Why?
It's caused a stir overseas. So we're heading to the US now. The New York Times media columnist, Ben Smith, who's a former news chief at BuzzFeed, wrote this article. And Farrow, if you don't know who he is son of Woody Allen and Mia Farrow. He is a star reporter who has been instrumental in the Me Too movement. His reporting has helped build cases against people like Harvey Weinstein and the Today host Matt Lauer. If you don't know those names, you obviously know Weinstein's name. But Smith's column is pretty remarkable in that he has decided to cast doubt upon Farrow's reporting, or at least decided to impugn Farrow's credibility. And so his article, it goes through a few different things, but it casts doubt on a few different things that Farrow has reported. He says that essentially it skipped over some potentially troubling witness testimony in a story about Lucia Evans, who accused Harvey Weinstein of a sexual assault. It talks about a story written in 2018 about files relating to Donald Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen, which disappeared from the Treasury Department servers. And he says that article essentially doesn't hold up. And the central allegation, though, if you can just summarize all of his allegations, it's that Farrow crafts narratives and he creates clear heroes and villains, but he doesn't necessarily corroborate all the details for all of his allegations, and sometimes he skips over inconvenient details.
Okay, if you're going to accuse one journalist of not quite maybe getting the facts all in order, then what facts does Ben Smith have to back up his arguments in the article without going into too much detail? Does he do that?
Now, this is in dispute. Really, like, I mean, Eric Wemple, the Washington Post media columnist, calls it muscular debunking work. You know, it does have its fans, as NBC's Dylan Byers, who called it maybe the most important media column I've ever read. But there's a lot of people that have essentially accused Ben Smith of doing what he accuses Farrow of doing, which is excluding things from his story that don't suit his narrative, and essentially only including convenient facts and things that really suit his mission, which is to undermine Farrow and to question his star power. And that has received some pushback. So one of Farrow's editors at the New Yorker, Michael Lowe, he has done a 16-part Twitter thread responding to a lot of Smith's allegations. And he said that a lot of the things that he mentions in that thread were actually supplied to Smith but weren't included in his column. And Slate's Ashley Feinberg makes a similar point. She accuses Smith of making an allegation without explicitly making it by choosing more convenient facts. In other words, exactly the type of practice that Smith deplores coming from Farrow.
Smith calls it resistance journalism, doesn't he?
That's true. So he's accusing Farrow of essentially going with the social media tides and taking on the people that lots of people on social media already hate. And there has been a bit of a considered response to that from the Columbia Journalism Review, which it argues that actually resistance journalism is really, in the form that Farrow does it, Harvey Weinstein wasn't a hated figure. Matt Lauer wasn't really a hated figure. They weren't figures that were unpopular on social media. All they were was powerful men that had unreported allegations against them. And so the CJR essentially argues that if that's what resistance journalism is, then we probably need more of it, not less, just people that are willing to take on powerful figures.
I mean, it's there other words for it, advocacy journalism, and there's another word that might describe what he's doing. Well, you carry on. You've got something you want to say there?
He's not advocating as much as just he's just prosecuting powerful people that have often gotten away with things just because of the nature of their position. And on the other hand, CJR does make one point where it agrees with Smith, which is, says, is Ronan Farrow too good to be true? Well, yes, because any superstar journalist is always going to be too good to be true, because journalism is not some mythic identity. It's something you do, and it's something that's carried out by people who have good days and bad days and can make mistakes.
Yep. And I guess when I think of some of the, like John Pilger or maybe a Mike Moore, and I think, well, I think there's a narrative there. And sometimes I think, well, it's not necessarily everything. The narrative tends to seek out the facts that support the narrative. And sometimes I think, well, that might be fine if it's a cause I support, but what if it was supporting something which I think is abhorrent? And it's just, I guess, one of the little doubts I sometimes have about that kind of journalism.
There's no doubt that Farrow is on the side of the people that report things to him. And I think that that is probably one of the key developments of Me Too, you know, that you should believe the people that make these allegations in the first instance. But he's said that he meticulously fact checks his stories. And that's been backed up by Dave Remnick at The New Yorker, his editors, other people like that. And so he'll defend, I think, to the wall, the integrity of what he is doing. And he's done that on Twitter. You know, he's responded to some of these critics. But the thing that gets me here is that, what is the purpose of Ben Smith's column? Because the stakes here are unusually high. It's not just criticizing another piece of reporting, because this is obviously, and Ben Smith would have known this, the Times would have known this, this is going to be used as ammo first and foremost by the men that Farrow accused of sexual misconduct and to repair their own reputations. That's already proved to be the case. Matt Lauer, the Today Show host that I mentioned earlier, he's already written a lengthy op-ed saying that Farrow has falsely accused him of things. And so this column, whether it's wrong or right, is going to be able to be used to cast doubt not just on Farrow's past reporting, but his future reporting. And it might dissuade victims from going to him again to report their abuse, knowing that their credibility will be questioned. So it has unusual stakes, and so I think it should require unusual proof, and I'm not sure that Smith has got there with this.
But maybe there's another thing to ask here, and that is whether Ronan Farrow was the only person who was writing about these allegations of sexual abuse. He wasn't, was he? There are others that came forward, other journalists that wrote other people's stories.
No, and I mean the Times itself. Farrow is one of the people that is most associated with the Me Too movement. He's written incredible stories and he's done incredible work, but he's not the only one. Obviously, there's Jodi Kantor at the New York Times, among many others that have done great stories in the Me Too reporting. So it's not like he stands alone, and that if he falls, then the whole edifice is going to fall. It's just that his reporting is important, and that if you're going to impugn his credibility, then you should really have a pretty decent case to make.
Yeah, but I guess taking it another way, if you don't rely on one journalist, I mean, I wouldn't rely on John Pilger for my worldview, or Mike Moore, no matter how much I might admire them. I wouldn't rely on any journalist. I would want to see who else writes, who is researching the same area, what they come up with. Maybe which sometimes means it takes time for you to see whether you've got a picture you can rely on.
Absolutely, and I mean that's laudable. Brian. Yeah, and that's,
and
that's,
I'm out of touch.
Just don't trust any one person. Pick your sources widely. Try and read the people that disagree with you, even if you hate it. But I mean, journalists are people that make mistakes, as I mentioned earlier.
Oh yeah. And, are we moving on to the next topic now? The brickbat.
this is a clip that I'll play. This is what News Hub led with on Monday night.
Kia ora, good evening. It's official. Jacinda Ardern is the most popular Prime Minister the country's had in a century.
Right.
That sounds...
Yeah, well, that's lost me already. I mean, yeah. most popular prime minister the country's had in a century. And I'm already thinking before whatever you say, I'm based on what? Away you go, Hayden.
Yeah. So there was Sam Hayes introducing Monday's mind-blowing News Hub poll. Now that showed Jacinda Ardern on 59.5% in the preferred prime minister stakes. But you're right. Based on what? So there are some pretty that claim appears to be shaky at best. The Herald has done an analysis of the claim, featuring Grant Duncan, an associate professor of politics at Massey University, and they've thrown up quite a few problems. I mean, one problem is that opinion polls weren't even carried out prior to 1974. It appears so. It's really hard to
that's
say.
That's not a century.
Not quite a century ago. So that's really makes it really hard to say whether Jacinda Ardern was more popular than Norman Kirk or Michael Joseph Savage. But, I mean, it's possible at least. In addition, the claim only really applies, it seems, to the News Hub Read poll, which has been running since 2009, which is also obviously not a century.
Yeah.
But it does appear that a lot of Herald Digi polls show John Key's support at higher than 59.5% of the preferred prime minister.
He was pretty popular.
He was quite popular, you will remember. And so one had him as high as 73.3% even. So that is far and away above the 59.5%. This claim only really works if you compare Labour's support in the opinion poll, which was actually at, I'm going to check, 56.5%. to actual election results over the last century, and that's where they actually do come out on top. So if Labour actually did get 56.5% in the election, that would be a record. The last best election result was 55.6% of the vote for Michael Joseph Savage's party in 1938.
It's a bit of a stretch. I mean, for one poll means an election result. Yeah. I mean, they could, they got a bit excited. They got a bit excited.
Yeah, so I mean, exactly. It's excitement, and the Herald obviously fact checked that itself. But the Herald has had its own problems with facts this week. So this just today, actually, there was a story that came out where the Herald accused Labour MP Tamati Coffey of telling a small businessman who just complained about his financial woes during the lockdown that the prime minister was also doing it hard. So, of course, that looks really bad because it's just an out-of-touch Wellington politician sort of safely nestled in his public job telling a struggling business owner that this prime minister is suffering just as much. And people said as such, you know, it was labelled tone deaf. It was said that Tamati was being very tone deaf. The only problem is that the quotes as given weren't actually said, and this is Coffey's actual statement.
Thank you, Reg. Thank you for that. You made the comment that obviously that you've been tested mentally, and I just want to acknowledge that. We all have, not least our Prime Minister, who's had to make that decision, big, bold decisions based on the country's best interests.
Okay, I didn't hear doing it hard in there. I was wondering why I was getting texts from people saying doing it hard and thinking, where's that come from? There must be some reason they're using that phrase. And now I know, thanks to you, Hayden.
No, thanks to me. No worries about that. So the phrase doing it hard doesn't actually appear in Coffey's statement.
No.
But it was used as a direct quote in the Herald story, which is a little bit unusual. And the actual quote is far less inflammatory because it's quite clear that Tamati Coffey is talking about the mental strain that the lockdown has placed on people and saying that obviously the Prime Minister has had some of that mental strain having to make these big decisions. And it's really hard to say exactly how the Herald got it so wrong because these were direct quotes. It's very unusual to have direct quotes that are just totally invented, seemingly. Now, Axe David Seymour was quoted in the original story, and he said that Coffey's statement was outrageous. So it's possible, this is just my theorizing, it's possible that maybe David Seymour mischaracterized what was said to the reporter and then it was just reported. Maybe the reporter misheard or misinterpreted Coffey's statement via a faulty Zoom stream. It's possible. who knows? But I reported the I contacted the reporter in question, and he only made the following statement. He said, "All I will say is I made a mistake and I apologize for it." He did actually apologize for it, I should say. He apologized later in the day and he issued a correction. And a correction was placed on the Herald story sort of later in the afternoon. So, and this is the second part of the statement, "As journalists, that does regrettably happen from time to time." He wouldn't say any more than that.
Well, good on him for saying he made a mistake and apologizing for it. Better than trying to say that I didn't, and that somehow that quote did actually happen when it didn't. What does this all mean for the media, Hayden, though?
It sort of played out over sort of 6 hours or so. The story went up in the morning, and then it was sort of retracted gradually as the afternoon wore on. And, sorry, what was that, Brian, your question?
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of a couple. Do you think there's any particular pattern here, Hayden, or is it just, you know, media under stress, we make a mistake, media get overexcited, once again, to try and encourage people to watch your television program, so they talk about a poll being the most significant poll in 100 years, or whatever they said, most popular government in 100 years? These are just things that media do some from time to time, Hayden, or do you think there's something a bit deeper going on here?
I think that really you've probably nailed it there. We don't really have a nakedly partisan media like they do in the US. We don't have a Fox News. We won't have reporters that will just set out to distort facts to suit an agenda. News Hub often does, interestingly, get criticized for apparently going to for reporting to suit an agenda, but I don't think they do that. They just their agenda is more political blood and drama, and they often get leaked stuff because they kick harder than anyone else. But that's beside the point. I think that probably what's happening here is what you say. It's just people that are looking to create a little bit of interest and a little bit of drama and possibly over-egging what was actually said or the information that was actually there.
Hayden, thank you very much for joining us again.
I do want to add one more possibility.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
Which is that possibly, just like all of us, reporters are just incredibly tired right now, making a few mistakes. Possibly.
Yes. Are you tired, Hayden?
I'm actually doing okay, but I'm guessing that the people down in the beehive that have been going to these daily conferences every day are a little bit tired right now. So maybe we should cut them some slack.
And maybe the angles, just try to find something new and fresh. We've been in a pandemic for a few weeks now. You know, in terms of your normal news cycle, this story has been going for a while. Maybe people do get tired because there's just not the new angles, and then they start stretching stuff.
Yeah, maybe you get a little bit addicted to the readership and to the adrenaline of getting clicks and seeing things succeed. I don't know. That sort of happened to me in the past. That's possible. I wouldn't really want to speculate. Exactly.
Well, speaking of speculation, now that I've sadly, listeners, we don't have time for the silver lining in terms of the drop in carbon emissions because we've got to go to the news in about a minute and a half, Hayden. But never mind.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
No, don't worry about it, Hayden. Don't worry.
Down substantially.
No,
that's
don't.
The summary.
But, you know, is there any update on the whole NZME and stuff?
Not that I have to hand at the moment, besides that obviously NZME's attempt to force stuff back into negotiations has been turned down by the by the High Court. Now, the question is why exactly stuff wanted to back out of those negotiations in the first place, right? And so maybe, just maybe, there is another buyer there. There's someone else that wants to acquire stuff. Already the NBR's publisher, Todd Scott, has put his name forward as someone that wants to acquire them. It's whether there is someone else out there as well that wants to acquire stuff for more than NZME's admittedly tempting offer of
$1. Hayden, thank you very much for joining us again. Enjoy the rest of your evening.
Thank you so much, Brian. You too.
Hayden Donnell, he will be back with another Midweek Media Watch next Wednesday at around about 10:30. And there'll be a full edition of Media Watch this coming Sunday morning with Jim Moore. Colin Peacock will be anchoring the show. They'll know about a few reports in there from Hayden as well.